Hey, welcome back to the podcast. This is Greg Kelly. This is my podcast in addition to my radio show and TV show and Twitter account. Now, something to say about the Twitter account. You may notice a change going forward. I have decided to tone it down a notch. Yes, I know. Some people are not happy about that. I don't know if I'm happy about that. But listen, a delegation of community leaders, clergy, extended family, government officials came to me imploring me to, Greg, could you tone it down a notch? So I'm going to tone it down a notch and we'll see what happens. Okay. I may not be tweeting as much. I may delegate a little bit of those responsibilities to someone else and let's see how it goes. So, look, there's a time and a place for everything. There's a season for this stuff. And I just think I need to focus a little bit more on my surroundings, like my physical immediate surroundings, the people, the environment, the whatever. But look, I'll still be out there at Greg Kelly USA. In the meantime, we resume today a conversation with the author of one of my favorite books in a long time. The author is Dwight Chapin. He was a very key aide to President Richard Nixon, and both as president and before he was president, as a former vice president. When he ran for governor, Dwight Chapin was there. Anybody who knows anything about Nixon or Watergate has definitely heard the name Dwight Chapin. A really great guy, and his book, The President's Man, The Memoirs of Nixon's Trusted Aide, is a delight to read. Came out just a couple of months ago, published by William Morrow, and I've just finished all 400 some odd pages, and it is a delight. A lot of life lessons in here, and again, if you like history, if you're intrigued by Richard Nixon, and he is one of the most intriguing political figures of all time, you will love this book. And even if you don't like to read books, I think you'll enjoy very much getting to know somebody I now consider a friend, really, and an honor to spend time with him and to talk with him. This is Dwight. Now, I should point out, all right, Dwight Chapin was the appointment secretary under Richard Nixon. He did not get mixed up in Watergate or anything like that. It's Watergate's very, very complicated. We talk about it. He did actually go to jail. Totally unfair. Totally ridiculous, but that's America for you in so many ways. The man came out on top, is on top, and I think he has led an exemplary life and just an all-around terrific individual. And I look forward to you enjoying this conversation with Dwight Chapin, author of The President's Man, The Memoirs of Nixon's Trusted Aide. Dwight Chapin, welcome back and thank you again. Part two. Excuse me. This is, what's the reaction been like from the book? There are a lot of Nixon files out there. What's the reaction been like? What do people tell you?
The book, the reaction has been wonderful. People tell me, I guess, what they think I want to hear, but I also find in that terrific sincerity and lots of compliments about understanding Nixon better, getting a handle on that, understanding what happened with me in regards to Watergate, and loving so many of the stories.
And also, actually, on Watergate, oh, gosh, this was the clearest, most concise explanation of the whole affair. And you point out that we still don't know everything, but you could follow it, and just about every book gets awfully confusing awfully fast on Watergate, and yours is different.
Well, I tried to have in mind the complexity of it and therefore use the denominator of simplicity. I mean, I really try to just zero in on some key elements of it. It's much more complex when you look at it in its totality. But I went for the nuggets, and particularly, as I explained, the ones that directly had involved me.
But it was interesting also because I felt almost relieved because the story is incredibly complex. But you say there are people who were involved who don't understand it very well.
That's true.
And that was interesting. All right. So, look, I want to start. You're in the White House, and you've got one of the dream jobs in the world. And then there's an accusation. It's totally preposterous and stupid, but there's some sort of gay sex ring going on in the White House, and it is, let's underscore, preposterous, and it's made up. But they took it very seriously. Can you tell us about what happened first?
Yes. Well, what happened is, historically, in terms of the Nixon operatives, and I'm talking now about the senior staff, Bob Haldeman, John Ehrlichman, being the two principals in this particular story, and then their young assistants or staff people, which would be myself and Larry Higbee in particular, who worked for Bob Haldeman. We would travel together. We would always travel with the president, and we would end up down in San Clemente or out in Key Biscayne, and we would work well into the night and go back and forth between each other's villas. Well, there was a Washington reporter, a columnist, I should say, by the name of Jack Anderson, and he had a group of people that worked for him, and somehow someone gave them the idea of following us, and with the thought being that this was some kind of a homosexual situation. You're right, it was absolutely ludicrous, but they came to the conclusion, Jack Anderson came to the conclusion that there was some merit to this. So what happened was, one afternoon in May of 1969, so we had just not even been there a complete year yet, Haldeman buzzed and said, "Can you come in?" I went into his office, and seated there was Ehrlichman, Larry Higbee, Bob's assistant. I sat down. Herb Klein, who was the communications director, was there. And Haldeman said, "We're waiting for John." That John was John Mitchell, who was the Attorney General of the United States, who was right through the door sitting with the president talking over the matter he was getting ready to talk to us about. So Mitchell came in, maybe 5 minutes later, and he said, "Gentlemen, we have a problem." He said, "Herb, why don't you explain?" So Herb Klein, the communications director, who had been in touch with Jack Anderson, Jack Anderson had called him to tell him that he was about ready to run this story. And Klein had said, "Please hold on," and got Mitchell involved because of the severity of it. And Mitchell met with Nixon. And so the name of the game was to get to the bottom of this particular situation and prove whether or not it was true or not. And they came up with a plan. Herb Klein called and talked to Anderson and said if the men would swear, go under oath and swear to the facts that you were about ready to report, give their side of the story and swear to it, would you accept that? And Anderson put a couple of conditions on it. I'm not exactly sure what the conditions were, but I believe that one of them involved one of the principals that was about ready to interview us. I went into the next morning into the cabinet room, and I kind of couldn't believe my eyes, to be truthful. There was a lady there, and on one side of her was her boss, who was J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI. And there was another agent there also. I don't know his name. But Director Hoover's secretary swore me in. Then started answering questions, some of which came from Director Hoover himself. And so that's basically the heart of the story. I was given the next day a transcript of this interview, and I signed it. And the other men were all interviewed. I don't know that everybody was interviewed by J. Edgar Hoover or that Hoover participated in theirs. I really don't know. But I know I did, and I signed it. And what happened next was, well, first of all, Jack Anderson decided to drop the matter. So it went away. Then it resurfaced again with Evans and Novak. Bob Novak and Raleigh Evans were columnists of another paper, not the Post, a syndicated columnist, quite popular in the country. And it came up again. And I have found out since I wrote my book, I have found out that this was instigated by none other than Murray Chotiner, one of the older of the Nixon associates that had been with Nixon for years. His trail goes all the way back into the Senate campaign against Helen Cahagan Douglas when there were charges of a pink paper being issued.
He's the one, you found that out, he's the one who started that he gave him that tip. Or that
he evidently is the one where that tip came from, and I never knew that until just recently.
All right, so fascinating, because that's kind of what I wanted to ask you about, because you wrote in the book that it was very unnerving that somebody would lie like that, somebody was that jealous, had such a chip on their shoulder.
He evidently hated Haldeman and Ehrlichman. Now, this is a man that had been in a real power position. It was Murray Chotiner who, when Eisenhower was thinking of pushing Nixon off the ticket and had Tom Dewey call Nixon and suggest that maybe he should not, this was during the fund scandal of 1960, 1952. Very good. Of 1952. When that push was made on Nixon, both Mrs. Nixon and Murray Chotiner said, absolutely no way, you are not going off that ticket. So,
first of all, did you know that Murray Chotiner hated Haldeman already? Was that already established in your mind?
No, because I have it in me, Greg, a very naive streak, and I just don't think that way. I mean, I'm not thinking of Shakespearean plots. You know, I'm a kid at this point. You know, I'm a very young man just learning the ins and outs of all this.
But this was a moment. I mean, you correct me if I'm wrong, you realize, wow, I got a target on my back.
Was a huge moment. And it's harder to grasp it today because we have become much more civilized and knowledgeable about gays and sensitive to how we treat the issue and so forth.
Well, back then,
it was a whole different story.
And you could have been driven from government. You could have been
ruined my life.
Now Chotiner, God, how did you find out that it was him?
There's a professor at the University of Maryland who's written a book about Jack Anderson, and it's buried in that book.
How about that? Now, he was kind of miffed. He was at the White House for a little while, and then they kind of stuck him, I think, at the committee to reelect, right?
No, I don't believe he ever got that. He got involved in a car wreck and passed away, and he was not at the committee to reelect. He was moved to the executive office building. Well, actually, I think he always had his office in the executive office building, and he was put on political-type matters, working with various politicians around the country.
But he felt slighted, he felt overlooked or
obviously
something.
Yeah, he felt that he should have more power than he did.
Can you do me a favor? A lot of folks outside of the business of politics don't understand advance work, what it is, what it means, and why it's important. Just can you go through that in a minute or so? What is it, and why is it so important?
Yes, an advance man is a representative, and in this case, either candidate Richard Nixon or President Richard Nixon, that goes into a town or a situation ahead of the visit by the president or the candidate and sets up all the arrangements with the county chairman, the state chairman, the local people. If a crowd's necessary, they build the crowd. They make all the hotel arrangements, all the parade route arrangements. They basically put together everything that's going to happen in that given area when the principal arrives.
And so many people get their start in that, I guess?
Yes.
Is that right?
Tremendous number did within the Nixon organization. Bob Haldeman was in 1960, he was what was called chief advance man, and he basically ran all of the advance men. So he came out of that pocket, as did John Ehrlichman, who had worked under Haldeman in 1960.
Hey, you got an award by the JCs, and but were you given the award in Salt Lake City on Inauguration Day?
I was, yes.
Now, why did you?
by Chet Huntley, no less.
That's a big deal. But yeah. You had a conflict, the inauguration. I was just curious why you.
The honor of the 10 outstanding young men in the country, that was quite an honor. And there was no way I was not going to be there for that. But what really sealed the deal is that my having to leave the White House had been, that word had been given to me at the very first part of December. So I knew I was going to be leaving, and I was not going to be a part of the second term. So it made the decision to go out to Salt Lake a little bit easier.
You knew, but you didn't have concrete plans, right? You didn't. They were still kind of hazy.
I did not know who would employ me. I was out interviewing. I interviewed all over the place. I had great help. People assisted me in getting interviews with top-notch organizations. I mean, I remember coming to New York and meeting with the president of American Express. I had a meeting with J. Willard Marriott of the Marriott Corporation, a great friend of Nixon's and a wonderful human being. It was Justin Dart, who was very prominent in the Reagan organization, but he ran Dart Industries in California. And when I went out to meet with Mr. Dart, he said, well, I'm on the board of United Airlines. He said, we're looking for a marketing person. You're perfect. And he said, let me call Eddie Carlson. He picked up the phone and called the chairman of United. And the next thing I knew, I was set up with interviews.
But okay, so why did you want to leave? I mean, this is before Watergate became a thing. But you knew you wanted to leave. You have a great – why did you want to leave?
No.
Wait.
Let me help you a little bit on that. After the election in 1972, I went to Ireland for 3 weeks. And during the time that I was in Ireland, there was a lot going on that I was completely unaware of.
All right. I'm sorry. Now you get back on December 3rd. Phone rings. It's John Dean.
Right. I go from Andrews Air Force Base to my desk in the White House, and you're right. The minute my seat touched the chair, the phone rang. White House operator says, I have Mr. Dean calling you. John said, welcome back. He said, I'd like to talk with you. And I said, why don't you come by and we'll have a cup of coffee tomorrow morning. Terrific. So the next morning, which was Monday, he came in, sat down. We talked about how great Ireland was or is. And then he said, have you given any thought to what you're going to do? And I said, John, what are you trying to tell me? And he says, well, you need to be figuring out what you're going to do. And so the light went on, and I said, does Bob know you're here? Meaning Bob Haldeman. And he said, yes. And I said, get the F out of my office. I was stunned. I went over to my phone on my desk. I'd been in a little sitting area with John and went over to the desk, sat down, ask for Haldeman, who was at Camp David. The White House operator put me through. And I said, Bob, is there something you want to tell me? And there's this silence. And he said, why don't you come up here tomorrow and we'll talk? And I can remember saying to him so clearly, tomorrow? Why would I wait till tomorrow? And he says, well, we're all set with schedules for today, so it'll have to be tomorrow. That was the start.
Okay. And the next day, you get let go. So let's go back to, you get called in, I think, to the Oval Office, and Haldeman is there, and the president is there, and they tell you to hire a Dick Tuck type of guy, right?
That's right. That's exactly what happened.
Who said that? Who said Dick Tuck? Was it Nixon or Haldeman?
Haldeman.
And tell everybody who Dick Tuck is or was.
Yes, Dick Tuck was a Democrat, a Democrat prankster. By that, he would pull various tricks or, I guess you could call them funny incidences on Republican candidates, particularly Richard Nixon. To give you an example, Nixon's running against Jack Kennedy in 1960. Nixon is getting ready to campaign in San Francisco and Chinatown. Behind Nixon, at the podium, and behind that podium is this big banner that in Chinese says "Vote for Kennedy." Nixon is clueless; he has no idea what it says. But Dick Tuck had made it possible for that banner to be there. Dick Tuck arranged at one occasion for Nixon, who was giving a talk from the back of a caboose of a train. He's midway through his talk as the train starts to pull out. I mean, it was, you know, it's stuff like this. So that was what I knew as Dick Tuck type activities. And it was so common to what I was used to that the request by Bob didn't have any sinister feeling to me. I can remember running at one of the conventions immediately, I don't know, before we got elected, I think it was, that I had run into Dick Tuck at the convention, and this is at the Republican convention. He had on every delegate badge known to mankind with the maximum access to anything he wanted to attend. How he got those and so forth, I have no idea.
So you understand what Dick Tuck is and what that assignment means, and you think pretty much right away Donald Segretti would be a good guy for that. Donald Segretti.
My mind went right to Don. I knew he was getting ready to leave the service. He had been a roommate at USC. Perfect.
And a lawyer.
And he was, a graduate of Bolt Law School at Berkeley, so very smart.
And that was the key, right? You wanted a lawyer because you wanted to make sure everything was legal. I mean, you could kind of, you know, some of this stuff, you wanted to make sure he wasn't breaking the law. Or you tell me, did you want him because he was a lawyer as well?
Well, Don said when he testified to a grand jury that when Dwight talked to me, he said, one of the reasons I'm picking you is because you are a lawyer and you'll be able to know what's right and what's wrong. I don't remember it being such a conscious thing, but Don clearly remembered it.
Do you remember where you had the first face-to-face meeting about going to work for this effort?
It was it was in May, and it was outside at a restaurant very close to the White House on one of the side streets. We were outside.
And so those kinds of pranks, they were done. They're done at the college level. They're done at the presidential level. They're done at the Congress. They're done at least prior to 1972 all the time by everybody. Is that fair to say or no? How would you characterize it?
I would characterize it as every campaign season, there are some things that are tricks. They have gotten dirtier or more convoluted. The Russia hoax that Trump went through being probably the worst of all.
Yeah. But the other ones, just harmless stuff, kind of sending people. What's an example? Go ahead.
Yes. There first of all, there's no question. I can remember my mother coming at me when all this started unfolding, and she was not a happy camper. She said, "Son, you know, nobody should be messing around with how the democracy works and so forth." I said, "Mom, look, you know, it's not that bad, but it can get out of hand very quickly." And some of the stuff that Don did got out of hand. He wrote a very nasty brochure thing on Shirley Chisholm, who was a black congresswoman from Manhattan. And she was running for president, and the piece was too far. He went too far. So it can get out of check very quickly. I did not give him specific instructions on any piece of literature that I can remember, even as of this moment that I remember.
And Segretti was not, by the way, involved in Watergate. I mean, in terms of the break-in, in terms of the... Nothing like that.
No, but his name ended up in an address book that was in E. Howard Hunt's safe at the White House. And his name got in that address book because he was doing some activities up in Wisconsin. And the people from the committee to reelect the president also had an operative up there, and somehow the wires got crossed, and they got onto Don Segretti. And when this happened, Jeb Magruder, who was the deputy campaign manager, wrote a memorandum to Bob Haldeman and to John Mitchell saying that whoever this operative is, nobody, you know, we have got to put him under the operation at the committee to reelect the president. And so that was signed off on by Bob Haldeman and Mitchell. Both of them agreed to that. And Segretti was then moved to being coordinated by Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt.
Yep.
But he only met with them once in Florida, and they never asked him to do anything. But his number ends up in the address book.
All right. One thing, why you're very scrupulous about, okay, Segretti, you know, you don't work for the White House, you know, we're going to maintain our distance. Meanwhile, Howard Hunt has an office in the EEOB, correct?
Right.
For a time. Who made that mistake? I mean, like, that just seems...
Of him having an office?
Him having an office. I mean, like, there should have been the distance that you ensured existed between Segretti and others, right?
Well, but Hunt was... brought in and assigned to do some work for Chuck Colson. And I also believe he did some work for the plumbers. And so he had an office in the executive office building. He evidently never officially vacated that office because there was a safe there with stuff in it. And this ended up being kind of at the heart of, you know, all of a sudden involving the White House and the whole Watergate affair.
So early on, the story is percolating in Washington, D.C. The nation really hasn't caught on. They don't really care, but D.C. cares. And that's when your name and Segretti's name become bigger and bigger and bigger in D.C. And that leads to Haldeman saying, "You got to go."
Yes, but that it didn't happen until really in October. So the break-in is in June. And Segretti getting identified by Woodward and Bernstein, it doesn't happen until October. And it's right in that period of around October 9th that my name surfaces. And when it surfaces, Greg, it comes up that I was involved with Segretti and that there were 50 or so espionage agents doing sabotage. I mean, the language, the inflammatory language and the positioning of this is what is so critical. And what really was the problem for the president and for Bob Haldeman was that my name is now into the news on this, and I am part of a battery ram to get through the doors into the White House.
And everything, a lot of what's being written, you just alluded to it, is totally inaccurate, just over the top,
over the top.
Wild.
And in fact, in All the President's Men, the book by Woodward and Bernstein, they referenced the fact that their editor at the Post kept upping how close I was to the president and the amount of espionage and the amount of sabotage. You know, they had to make the story have more gravitas, and that's that. I was a victim of that.
You know, I don't like those guys, but having said that, you make me think of when Segretti meets with Bernstein in the movie. At least they're kind of trying to acknowledge what you just said, that it was low level stuff. It was just fun and games. It was the stuff we did in college.
Well, that may be how Woodward and Bernstein approached Segretti to keep Don of a certain state of mind and therefore reveal more mm-hmm. or whatever. But the motive, and as it got back to the Post, and the leverage that they wanted to use it for was to get in the doors, to get to Haldeman, and to get to the president. So it gets escalated. They may talk to Don and say, you know, oh, this, you know, we're just trying to find out what the facts are here.
Right.
You know, but boy, that changes as they move ahead.
Do me a favor. I'm going to ask you this question, and just, I think I know what your initial reaction is, but if you don't mind just thinking on it for an extra 10 seconds, all right? Because your name becomes, you're very famous during this period, right? You're on all the front pages, and I do believe you're innocent. I, you know, the charges, we'll get into that. But is there ever a point where you start to kind of a little bit enjoy the notoriety? I think anybody who gets that kind of attention for a little while, there's a temptation potentially. This is not a bad thing, by the way. I'm just wondering if you, wow. I mean, nobody knew who the appointment secretary was before you or after you. They know who Dwight Chapin is. You walk into a room, there's buzz. Did you ever come to, like, hey, you know, this is, you know, wow.
Well, the Sunday, the newspaper story on Segretti and myself came out on a Saturday night late. And that's... Next day, Sunday, I'm sitting in the Roosevelt room, and John Ehrlichman is there asking me questions because he knows nothing about Don Segretti, and he's trying to figure out what the hell is going on here. Ziegler, who is press secretary, is walking in and out. John Dean, who has come back from his honeymoon, is in and out. Dick Moore, who is my great friend and public relations-oriented guy, is working on a statement, and I am thinking, this is not good. I have never been part of the issue around Nixon. I've always enjoyed a very positive, very supportive role, and all of a sudden, I'm becoming a focus. So I don't remember, Greg, ever thinking this is good.
No, I guess. And I
did the celebrity side of it. I mean, later, you know, we would go places or I'd go anywhere. My name became so well known, particularly in Chicago where I'd moved. So there is a moment of, oh, I'm known, but it's like I'm a counter hero, not a
counter hero.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I know obviously in the Roosevelt room and gosh, you're in trouble basically. You know what I mean? They're looking at you, but like 2 years later going through the trial, I know that was an ordeal, but okay. So you answered my question. There was never a moment where, you know, I don't know. You just kind of, it is what it is. And you start to kind of like, wow, you own it a little bit.
Yes. I would say that happened after Lompoc and going to prison, and as the year started unfolding, I started realizing that there was a certain cachet to it. And I think that may be what you're alluding to, and there definitely was a certain advantages that came through it. No one ever turned down a meeting with me because, you know, they may want to meet with me about whatever I was working on, but within, you know, 3 or 4 minutes, they also would do you mind if I ask you a question about Nixon or ask you a question about Watergate or ask you a question about Mrs. Nixon? So it ended up probably overall being an asset in terms of my whole life.
We now know that, well, they say that Mark Felt was deep throat. I've got my doubts about that. I think they made the whole thing up, quite frankly. A composite character, I think you refer to that. My question to you, though, is, you know, Mark Felt was scheming and doing all this stuff. He wanted to be the FBI director. And I almost felt sorry for him. It made me think, like, all these people doing all this scheming and the leaking and the nastiness and thinking, and even Dean, like, desperately trying to manage this story. I think that stuff, God is ultimately in control, correct?
Yes.
And I just wondered if you had any thoughts on these people who, I mean, I just happened to, I would imagine that you're not a leaker. And I've never been a leaker, but I've been, you know, I've had stories about me. And it's interesting, like, all the people who try to do the damage. I'm talking about the little stories. I remember them. What am I trying to say here? Is that, what do you make of those people? And do you think God is in control of everything? And why did they wait? Look at you. You're walking here now. You're healthy. You're happy. You've got everything. And they don't. They're all gone, by the way, you know? Well, and all that scheming did not get them anywhere. It didn't get them what they wanted.
Well, isn't it important in life that you be able to live with yourself? Hmm. So I don't know how some of these people live with themselves. I don't know how John Dean possibly lives with himself. Or Gordon Strawn. Gordon Strawn's a great friend of mine. He was, but I'm sure he's got some issues now because my book sets forth that not only John Dean knew about Watergate before it happened, Gordon Strawn knew. We had two people that knew about it prior in the White House. The first thing Nixon asked Haldeman, is anyone at the White House involved? And the answer came back no, because nobody knew that John Dean knew. Nobody knew that Gordon Strawn knew. So in terms of all these people and how I feel about them and so forth, I will say this, that I conducted myself through this whole process in such a way that every one of the participants, all of the men that I admired, like John Ehrlichman, John Mitchell, Bob Haldeman, Chuck Colson, all of those people, I had a continued friendship with. These were colleagues. These were people. I explain when I go to colleges or high schools or whatever and I talk to the kids, I explain these were not evil people. These were good men that made some rather dumb, to put it mildly, decisions. There were poor judgments made, but these were not evil men. These were not people that came into government and served to rape the democracy. I mean, I've stuck up for these people my whole life, and I will, God, heaven help me, I will till the day I die.
Now, forgive me for simplifying this, but I don't want to, just tell me if I got the gist of it right. You were questioned by the prosecutors in front of a grand jury, and that's how you got into trouble. They did not like your answers, and they portrayed your answers as dishonest, lies, perjury, whatever. And that's why you, that's ultimately why you went to jail.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. But when I went to the grand jury, there was a set of prosecutors that were the original Watergate prosecutors. One of them, a Glanzer, told me, he ended up at a law firm with a friend of mine. This is years later. He says, Dwight, we wrote a memorandum saying you were unindictable.
Right.
Okay? It was the Saturday night massacre where Nixon fired Archibald Cox, the Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, resigned. His deputy, Ruckelshaus, resigned. And at that point, they needed to find to replace them, and they did with Leon Jaworski, and then they needed to have somebody really quickly to put the heat on and to indict.
Okay.
And I was the poor victim there.
And again, it was the questions they nailed you on, the jury believed, it was really about how you hired Segretti and what your instructions were to him.
That's
right?
That's okay. Correct.
Which is kind of amazing. And quite frankly, now I understand it much better than I used to. You have a wild line here. When the government is after you, according to your attorney, there's no way to win. And he was warning you about perjury traps, and it's the easiest way to nail a person. It seems like that is still very much the case.
That is very much the case, and it's exactly what happened to me. And I was not—I'm not a lawyer, and I was not really briefed adequately for going into the grand jury. I had a lawyer that was given to me at the very last minute. I met with him the night before I went into the grand jury, and. For example, last weekend, it happened to be that I was going through some of this with a lawyer that had been a special counsel in earlier administrations. And he said, Dwight, did your lawyer tell you that you could have just said that you could have pled the fifth when you went into the grand jury? And I said, no, I never knew that. Not that I would have. But, I mean, when you're just a naive citizen going into a grand jury and you have prosecutors that know exactly what they're doing and trying to get you into certain positions to make statements. And I fell into that trap.
So I was a little bit surprised when you expressed regret, I think, to your daughter that the regret you have, the mistake you made, was actually countenancing or tolerating that Dick Tuck kind of stuff. Like, you feel genuine regret. You actually, I think you said, like, that kind of stuff undermines democracy. I was
surprised. Well, that's going back to my mother. Remember, I said a few minutes ago, that was the point my mother made to me. I think she's right. It does not serve any legitimate campaign purposes for people to be making decisions about where this country is going based upon the crap that, you know, we generated out of Segretti Enterprise.
So what do you think a reasonable penalty would be for that? In a perfect world, there's a Dick Tuck operation. No, like what?
Well, I don't know, but I do know that Don Segretti went had a misdemeanor and went to prison for 4 months for the misdemeanor, which was a mail fraud. He sent something through the mails, and that law has now disappeared. It doesn't even exist anymore. That's how minor it was.
How minor it was. Are you? He's still alive, correct?
He is. He's a terrific guy and a wonderful friend of ours.
Wonderful, wonderful. Can you tell us a little bit about your Christian? Is it a Christian Science? Christian Science. What is it?
Well, Christian Science is a religion, just like Presbyterian or Methodist or Baptist or something. It's a way of thinking. They have the book Science and Health and Key to the Scriptures was written by a woman, Mary Baker Eddy, many years ago. They do not propagate. They are not evangelist type people. It's a religion that people can move to if they so desire to. So it's very, I would say, not very well known because of that, because of the way that they have positioned the religion. And really, it's not supposed to be talked about. I am no expert on it. My mother was a Christian Science Sunday school teacher. Her parents were on my mother's side. My grandparents were Christian Scientists. And my good friend in the White House, Bob Haldeman, was a very strict Christian Scientist, as was John Ehrlichman. And they both practiced the religion.
It's one thing about John Ehrlichman. You actually speak about him quite fondly. And there's something about him. I think he looks a certain way. He doesn't necessarily look like the most friendly, approachable guy. And I was surprised and heartened to learn that he's a nice guy and a nice man.
He was a terrific man.
But, you know, in the interviews, he even seemed kind of like, you know, not sinister. Well, a little bit. PR standpoint, he was not that sympathetic.
Right. Well, that's because most of the interviews that you have seen with John Ehrlichman are ones that took place after he was indicted or related to Watergate. I'm not sure you've seen the ones when he would be on Meet the Press or Face the Nation explaining domestic policy. He was director of the Domestic Policy Council. Nixon's domestic policy, according to Tom Wicker, the Pulitzer Prize writer for the New York Times, he wrote a book. I think the title was called
One of Us.
Yes, exactly. And he says that Nixon's domestic policies are more significant than his foreign policy.
So it's interesting.
John Ehrlichman deserves credit for that.
And back then, I think it's wonderful. It's actually he was a lawyer in Seattle, and he gets a very big job. Citizens came to the White House to serve, unlike the way it is now, where it's really these technocrats. They're in the game for decades and decades and decades.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So let's get to you're convicted.
Yes.
April 1st. The trial starts in 1974, April 1st. When were you convicted? How long was the trial?
This trial was on the 1st on Monday, started on Monday, and I was convicted on Friday.
Jeez.
Jake Stein, my lawyer, had said, Dwight, it'll end by Friday because nobody wants to come back on Monday and they don't want to have to worry about it over the weekend.
And you were shocked, though, right? Still?
I was shocked. I thought we had a chance. But Jake Stein didn't. My own lawyer had said, Dwight, don't be prepared. Do not expect to win this with a Washington jury. You're a Nixon man. Nixon lost two places in 1972. He lost Massachusetts and the District of Columbia.
I am surprised that they still say the same thing about Washington, D.C. and the juries and the judges. I mean, it is still the same. I mean, it seems corrupt. It seems totally it's not justice.
You saw what happened a few weeks ago with Sussman.
Yeah.
The case was ironclad. But do you know that the District of Columbia, I believe, I may be a little off here, I think Trump got 15% of the vote in the District of Columbia. Hmm. So 85% of the vote went the other way for Biden. That's a clue right there.
I know, but you would still think that there's, you know, the system is not supposed to be based on who you voted for. You know, it's just not.
Well, we are good Americans and we like to believe that. But it's so divisive right now. It's so political. And very honestly, it was back then, too. My judge was Gerhard Gesell. Gerhard Gesell was a Johnson appointee. He raised holy hell with all of the Nixon people coming through, particularly John Ehrlichman, and he really put it to me. He was he gave me a sentence that was completely disproportionate. Most of the men, John Dean, Jeb Magruder, Chuck Colson, these people served 4 months. I served 9 because he was so pissed off that I had gone forward and maintained that I was innocent and even took it to trial. Most of the other people pled out their cases and didn't go to trial. I didn't do that because in my heart of hearts, I knew my intentions and I had no intention to lie when I went to that grand jury.
Why couldn't the prosecutors see it that way? Do you think they're dishonest? Do you think they are just driven? They need a scalp. Jaworski, the special prosecutor, comes every day of the trial. I mean, this is an educated person. I mean, he's taken philosophy. Some of these people are men of God.
You see, we're in political combat. This is political combat, and they're taking on the president of the United States, and it is as important to them that they win as it was important to Nixon and his men that they not succeed? I mean, it was a political battle.
Well, you said something in the book that I never put together. They were, a lot of these folks wanted back into power. They were Kennedy men.
Oh, this is very important.
And you have to destroy Nixon to give Ted Kennedy a chance somehow.
Well, let's look at what happened. Ted Kennedy was going to be the, you know, golden boy. And then he had the problem of Chappaquiddick and Mary Jo Pochekny getting killed. And the way that Senator Kennedy acted after that caused him great pain and put him into a very difficult position. So the Kennedy people were trying to figure out how they were going to rehabilitate him. Do you know that the original committee that started to investigate this thing called Watergate was in the committee headed by Ted Kennedy, a labor committee, I believe it was. And Mike Mansfield went to Kennedy and said, we're going to move this over to Sam Ervin because we've got to get it away from you because you can't be at the center of what we're going to be trying to do here. So saving Ted Kennedy's scalp was right in the forefront of the thinking of Mike Mansfield right at the outset of this whole thing. The other part that you should know is that the committee, the Republicans, said, okay, if we're going to be looking at the 1972 campaign, let's also look at 1968 when Johnson had the plane bugged, or 1964 when Barry Goldwater was running against Johnson and there were all kinds of tricks going on in terms of that intelligence and those campaigns. And the Democrats refused. They said, no, we're not going to study any of the other campaigns. We'll only study 1972. Oh,
they're vulnerable. Yeah. Did you ever hear the theory that Ted Kennedy was not in the car that night?
No.
It actually makes a lot of sense. He is, just if you don't mind, he's with the girl. They go, they have sex on the beach. His car, a police officer attempts to pull over a car matching Kennedy's description. And Kennedy is lost. This is the theory. This part is known, though. A cop observes the car, gets out of his car, approaches Kennedy's car, what is believed to be Kennedy's car. That car flees the scene at a very high rate of speed. The thinking is that Kennedy was paranoid, afraid that he would get caught ultimately with this girl in the car. So he says, you take this car. And, you know, you're on your own. I can't be seen with you. I got to get out of here. So he swims for it. She gets lost and dry. Now, that sounds, it's not exculpatory. It's actually worse for Kennedy, that circumstance. Like, he'd have to admit that I was with the girl, but I ran away because I didn't want to get caught by the cops.
Right.
In the other scenario, he can say, the publicly known scenario, I tried to save her. You know, I try, like there's an ounce of heroism.
Right.
But who knows? All right. So look, sorry. We're going to actually have to splice this up a little bit. Can you tell me a little bit about the time you first saw Spiro Agnew?
Well, I remember it was a Saturday and it was in the spring. So it was the spring of 1968. And Mr. Nixon had said that he was asked if I could come into town. We lived up in Coscob, Connecticut. And I came in by train, went over to the apartment, and we walked over to the penthouse apartment of Louise Gore. She was a national committee woman from Maryland. From a very wealthy family, and she was hosting at her apartment the committee women from across the country who were meeting in New York City, and the guest that they had invited was her new governor, Spiro T. Agnew, and she had been in touch probably with John Mitchell. To set this up, John Mitchell being the campaign manager for Nixon. And so Nixon walks over to Louise Gore's apartment. We go up the elevator into the room, and Louise greeted us. She introduces former Vice President Nixon to Ted Agnew. That was the moment they met for the first time. And so the women are all seated around. Louise says a few words, and then she invites Ted Agnew to talk. So Ted Agnew talked first, and that was for probably maybe 5 or 6 minutes. And then the former Vice President Nixon then talked to the ladies for probably 20 minutes and answered some questions. And then we left, and we're walking back to the apartment. And I must say, this didn't happen very often. But he did say, "Dwight, what did you think of the governor?" And as I recall, I said, "You know, well, he seemed very sharp, very articulate. He was immaculately dressed. I mean, the whole time that I knew Ted Agnew, which was for the whole time he was basically at the, you know, in the vice presidency. I mean, the guy always looked like he just stepped out of, you know, Esquire magazine or something. I mean, the guy was just perfectly dressed, and not a wrinkle ever anywhere in his clothing. So that was the first time. And then the next big event that happened was Nixon went around and visited several different governors that he was considering for vice presidency. And so one of those trips was to Annapolis, where the capital is in Maryland. So we go to Annapolis, and I remember there's this huge crowd as we're going in to see Governor Agnew. And they have this meeting, lasts maybe half an hour, 45 minutes. And then we left, and there's an equally big crowd on departure. And I thought, boy, somebody's very smart here, because all of the other places we went, the other governors didn't, you know, kind of turn out the crowd like Ted did. And I think that got Nixon's attention.
Isn't that wild?
I mean, that's it makes a difference. Crowds always affect politicians.
And if you don't mind, you're in Palm Springs. I think you're on your own. You get invited to a party by essentially Frank Sinatra. Some other person's there. We're having dinner at Frank Sinatra's house. Agnew is there. And lo and behold, you're there.
Yes, that was a great party.
Well, tell us a little bit about Frank Sinatra, if you don't mind.
Well, Frank Sinatra had been a Kennedy fan, and then Bobby Kennedy, I really don't know the history on this, but something happened that really crossed wires between the Kennedys and Frank Sinatra. And Sinatra took a liking to Nixon. He really liked Nixon. And he came to the convention in 1972. Sammy Davis, he got Sammy Davis Jr. to come, and Sammy Davis Jr. put on a special concert. There's a great picture of Sammy Davis Jr. and Nixon hugging each other after this concert right before the convention started. I saw Sinatra 3 or 4 different times during the convention. After hours, he was staying at the same hotel we were at. And he kind of held court downstairs in the bar after the convention. So at the 72 convention, I got unfortunately noticed that my grandfather, Dwight Chapin, had passed away. And so when it ended, I immediately went to Wichita, Kansas for the funeral. And then from there out to Palm Springs. Nixon, meanwhile, was going to Hawaii to meet with the Prime Minister of Japan. And so I'm taking a little breather. I've got 2 or 3 days in Palm Springs. And Joe Canzeri, a person that worked for Agnew, came by the house where I was staying and said, "Frank wants you to come for dinner tonight. The Agnews are in town." So I ended up over at Frank Sinatra's. I'll never forget walking up to the front door, pushing the button, doorbell rings. Next thing I know is that Sinatra opens the door, and like in the background is, you know, "Fly me to the moon," or whatever was his own voice, you know. And I stepped into the house, and the carpet must, you know, it was like it was 4 inches thick. I just kind of sank into it. He could not have been nicer. He took me all over the house, showing me things, took me out, showed me where the guest house was and his theater and so forth. And then up to he had a bar there in the house. And wouldn't know what I wanted to drink, and he got me a cocktail. And about that time, Judy and Ted Agnew came in from the guest house in which they were staying that was on the property. And then Jack Benny showed up, the comedian, and Rory Calhoun, who was an actor, and these kind of Hollywood people. And so everybody, it was cocktail hour, and then we went, moved into the dining room for dinner, and he had two round tables. And I was at a table with Barbara Sinatra, and Vice President Agnew was at that table, and myself, and Judy Agnew, the vice president's wife, sat over at the other table where Frank Sinatra was and some of the other guests. But the main thing that happened that was really ended up being an embarrassment for me was that I had had enough to drink that I said to the vice president, I said, "Boy, at the convention," the convention had taken place about a week and a half prior, I said, "You walked around that convention and had these Secret Service guys around you. It looked like a bunch of goons, and it was horrible. And you've got to change how you do all this." And the vice president's, you know, kind of there looking at me, and, you know, the other people at the table are kind of looking down at their plates.
Well, I'm relieved, quite frankly, because I read in the book, it came out a little bit differently. I didn't know you were at separate tables. I thought the inference, the implication was that these were mobsters. It looked like you were surrounded by mobsters.
It did look that way.
That it offended Sinatra.
No.
Oh, thank God. I mean,
no. No.
I mean, that's where I thought you were on thin ice. If only.
No. But I did say to the vice president, I said, "Sir," I said, "I can prove this. We have videotape." So we got back to the White House, and three or four days later, Nell Yates, my secretary, said, "Vice President's on the phone." I picked it up, said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Dwight, at Frank's, you said that you could prove these guys looking like thugs. He said, you said there's videotape. Can you put that together for me?" So I called Mark Good, who was in the television office that I was responsible for. I said, "Mark, here's the deal. Can you put together some clips?" And he did, and sent them over. And to his credit, the vice president called me back and said, "Dwight, you're right. I see exactly what you mean. We're going to make some changes."
What was the problem with what was it? Just dark sunglasses?
with President Nixon. Yes, we had great security. We had terrific people, but we stayed away from it. We gave him some airspace. I mean, the Agnew people are right around him, and I mean, it's very claustrophobic.
Yeah.
And then they were overweight and pudgy and dark glasses, and I mean, they just looked like a bunch of thugs.
Okay. Well, at least it was Ted Agnew, not Frank.
Right.
Because I thought you got out of there real quick. All right. If you don't mind. So jumping ahead, you're going to jail. Lompoc? What's
Lompoc.
It called? Lompoc. Right. By the way, have you seen the
Godfather? Flower capital of the world, by the way.
I think this facility is in The Godfather. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, that's where they hold the, in Godfather Part 2, they're actually holding a mafia boss at Lompoc. How
right.
do you say it again?
Lompoc.
Lompoc. It's a bad experience, I would imagine. You made the best of it. Tell us a little. Actually, before you get to that, you're going through a really hard time. This is all very stressful. And you meet somebody named Herm Stein. Can you tell us about him?
Yes. a quick story here. I knew from Jake Stein that I was going to be indicted on a Thursday, and he had called me Wednesday evening. In Christian Science Religion, they have a meeting on Wednesday evenings. So I went to the Wednesday evening meeting with the knowledge that the next day I was going to be indicted. And when it ended, when the meeting ended, I was on the way out of the sanctuary, and this elderly gentleman came up to me and introduced himself as Herm Stein and thanked me for being there that evening. I mean, it was kind of a welcoming type thing. And he said, Dwight, I live here in Winnetka. This is right on the edge of Lake Michigan. He says, you know, if you ever want to get together and talk, let me know. I said, Mr. Stein, I said, what are you doing tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock? Because I knew that was exactly when I was going to be indicted. And he said, well, I'm available. I said, well, can I come over? And I went over, and we walked the beach that morning, and I said that I needed to share something with him. And I said, while we're walking right now, I'm being in Washington, I'm being indicted. And Herm and I struck a friendship, and we got together every week that I was in Chicago, and that was, you know, almost constantly. I mean, for several years, the only intermission in our getting together was the time that I was off at Lompoc. So he was kind of a spiritual guider. He gave me wonderful advice. He assured me that I was God directed and God protected, and that no one could hurt me, and that when I got ready to go to prison the weekend before I went and met with him, and that's when he gave me the very important thought that going to prison, you know, that either I could make the most of it or it could get the best of me. And I thought, wow, that's real. And I never forgot that the whole time I was there. And he would send me stuff every week, little phrases or thoughts. And what Herm ended up being was an anchor. I mean, I made the point in my part one podcast with you, Greg, that I was so lucky with the mentors that I had in my life. And one of the most important was definitely Herm Stein.
Wow. And you're, by the way, you're great at maintaining friendships and correspondence. It's a different era. I mean, people write letters, not just when you're in jail, but you write letters and you receive letters. People wrote letters back then.
Yes, I have a file box full of the letters that I received at Lompoc. I had literally, I would say not even dozens, but hundreds of letters.
So how long were you in jail altogether? 9 months?
I was there 9 months.
Your first job, they gave you a job at the jail and it was perfect for you, right?
It was the ideal job. They didn't know it. They said to me that first morning, now we have to be very cautious because you are a high profile inmate here. So we're going to give you one of the toughest jobs. And they took me by truck out to a tractor out in a field. And I ran the tractor over this acreage with a disc machine. A disc is a designed to break up the soil, to break up the sods after the field had been plowed. They had no idea that when I was 14, 13, 12 years old, actually 12 years old when I first started, driving the tractor on the farm in Kansas with the disc thing behind my tractor, they couldn't have picked a better job for me.
Listen, you're being harassed, and there's a lot of racial consciousness in jail, and you're feeling some shade from the black inmates, and somebody makes a suggestion to you.
Yes, a older inmate said, you should go talk to Mike Davis. And I said, who in the world is Mike Davis? And he said, well, he's the head of the Black Cultural Workshop, and he might be able to help you. So I went over to his house. That's what he called his room. Knocked on the door. The door opens, and here's this guy, Mike, and he takes up the whole doorway. I said, Mike, my name is Dwight Chapin. I have something I need to talk to you about, a little incident situation. And he says, well, come on in. So I went in his room and explained to him that this kind of what I was calling harassment was taking place. And he asked me what I was in there for, you know, in Lompoc for, and wanted to know a little of my background. And then as I started telling him, he got very intrigued because he loved politics. And so the bottom line is there's two bottom lines. Number one, nothing ever happened to me again. No threats, nothing of any kind. People stayed away from me. So he had put the word out through his tom-toms or however he did it, and people stayed away. The other thing that was funny was that one of my best friends, Pat Buchanan, who is very conservative, had a new book that had just come out, and I had Pat send the book in, autographed, so that he had a very special gift from me, an autographed book from Pat Buchanan.
I love it. I love it. I love how you met him. I love how these things come about.
I should tell you that the talk with Mike Davis was really significant to me because, well, we talked a number of different times, but I remember him saying one time to me, Dwight, you have no idea what it's like to be standing on a corner. And keep in mind, Mike was a very big man. So if Mike was on the corner, you knew Mike was on the corner. He says, you have no idea what it's like when somebody pulls up with a car. And he was implying that the person was white at this point. And you hear the sound of the door lock because they've seen me. I thought that was really registered with me. I think about it all the time. When I see a black person standing on the corner, I think of Mike, and I think of that story about what it must be like if somebody pushes a lock because they look at you,
yeah,
and it's the color of your skin.
Wow. So the 9 months, overall, bottom line, I mean, what's your takeaway?
Well, my takeaway, I had some interesting experiences. I ran a job center. I finally got my own little office space, and I would help guys write resumes and try to get jobs for when they were going to be released. And to make myself productive, I tried to learn how to play the piano. I was not very successful on that. I took my weight down to 175, which is what I weighed when I got out of high school. I was in great shape. I started to lose it more mentally as time went on because I thought I was going to get out at like a 6 month mark, and then it was 7 months, and then it was 8 months, and so my the psychological side of, you know, when is this going to be over? Why am I being, why is this being drawn out? And why, you know, that really got to me. And I write about that and the fact that they wanted, the judge wanted me to write this conciliatory letter, you know, and I was not of a frame of mind to do that. I mean, I harbored deep feelings about the fact that I did not think I was guilty and why, you know, shouldn't be sitting there. But finally, I succumbed to what my lawyer told me I needed to do and wrote a letter saying, you know, obviously I wouldn't be sitting in Lompoc if I hadn't done something wrong. And so please forgive me, or however I put it. So that,
yeah, you have the text of the letter in there. I think you stayed true to your principles, but I was surprised and impressed actually that you apologized and you admitted wrongdoing, even though you didn't do anything wrong. Right? I mean, in terms of what you were there for. I just look. there are some guys, you've heard about this, they're stubborn. They're not going to take a plea. They're not going to, because they're totally innocent. I'm not going to put that in writing. And I just thought to myself, you know what? I have told lies before. Everybody has. You know what I mean? I have told white lies. I've told some big lies. Like, forgive me, but I feel like you lied to the judge in that letter in a good way. You want to hear I'm guilty? Fine, I'm guilty.
Yeah, that's basically, if you putting it that way, yes. I mean, I do believe that I misspoke to the judge. I mean, I didn't really feel I was guilty of doing what, you know, I was accused of and convicted of, by the way, by my fellow citizens. So I did what I was forced to do, and I don't like that. That goes against my nature. Right. My nature is not to be stubborn, but if I think I'm innocent and I really believe that in my heart of hearts, why would I say otherwise? Well,
you have an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old at home.
Yes, I do.
That's a big reason to say otherwise. And that's when I thought, like, you know what, I would write that letter too. All right, getting out of jail. Gosh, you had a lot of friends, and they were ready to help, weren't they? Oh, and I'm so sorry, but Bill Sapphire, of all people,
yes.
I mean, he's a great guy. When he
did you know Bill?
I never met him, although we share the same birthday.
Oh.
But he put in one of his columns that I'm writing a check for Dwight Chapin's defense fund.
Yes, that was huge, and helped. I mean, because there were, you know, I don't know how much money came in because of that, but people read Bill Sapphire's column and thought that they should contribute.
I guess when I was reading about your troubles and they're real in this, I just thought about somebody who didn't have the connections, who didn't have the White House, didn't have all those things. I mean, the government really can ruin you. I mean, totally ruin you. And what happens to these guys? You never hear about them. Do they go on welfare? I mean, what happens to them?
I don't know, but it's a very, when you have been charged, convicted, you go to prison or whatever, it's a very lonely experience. And it's one, I'm happy to say, I don't really know. I don't really know that experience because so many people supported me and stuck by me and helped me. They contributed to my defense fund. They loved me. My family loved me. So I haven't experienced the agony and the defeat and the trauma and the horribleness, if there is such a word, of the kind of situation you just described. Because I had such great support. Greg, through the whole thing, I had support. It doesn't mean I didn't have personal trauma and agony that I went through, because I did. But if you really cut through it, I was a very lucky man, even going through that part of it.
Does your conviction, your federal conviction, manifest itself or affect you in any way today in terms of, you know, your administrative life, getting a license? Do you have to identify yourself as a convict? Does it ever come up? And are you officially? What are you now officially?
Well, I'm a convicted felon.
Jeez.
and let me tell you that the procedures for getting a gun, I went in on Long Island to purchase a rifle, shotgun, and they put me through the machine deal, and I got immediately turned down. I mean, it was so I am in the registry and cannot have a gun. We went to Zimbabwe as part of a trip in Africa, and two of my stepsons were with me, me and my wife, and so I showed them that I was filling out the landing form, and I put under wherever it called for, if I had had any convictions, I said felony and put down, you know, what had happened. So I'm showing the boys that I'm, you know, putting the truth down. Well, we landed. It took us about 2 hours to get out of the airport because of this. And I was put under house arrest in Zimbabwe because of Watergate. And I was ordered to come back to the airport, I think it was 4 hours or something ahead of time on the departure, at which time the immigration guys were there asking me all these questions about Watergate because they wanted to be entertained.
Wow. I mean, just, I know you applied for a pardon, or you put the paperwork together. Did you ever officially apply?
No, I did not. My father had asked on his deathbed that I try to get a pardon to restore my good name. So I had promised to do this. It was an opportune time. It involved the Bushes, and I had known both 41 and 43. And so it would have been a time to do it. I started looking into it. It was incredibly expensive. I mean, it was going to cost, you know, $100,000 or whatever. By the time we got through it all, it takes forever. There's all this, the stack of paper, I swear to God, it was 5 inches high, of everything that had to be filled out about my life. And so I called my daughters and I said, you know, when your granddad was about ready to pass away, he made this one request of me. And both girls said, Dad, look, we love you. Why are you doing this? And I made a decision that, you know, I was not going to go ahead with that, that the people that mattered in my life, that cared about me, my friends and everything, having a pardon or not having a pardon was not going to make any difference at all. So I did not go ahead.
Can I ask you this? You go to you go back into the private sector. You flourish working for Mr. Stone.
Yes, W. Clement Stone.
And can you tell us a little bit about your work at Success Magazine and that overall kind of self-help movement that you were a part of? And what does PMA mean? PMA.
PMA means positive mental attitude. And Mr. Stone was known really as Mr. Positive Mental Attitude. As I said in my first session with you, I asked him what that his definition was at one point, and he said, well, it doesn't mean going around going whoopee. It means having the right attitude in a given situation. Our magazine was a very positive magazine. I was taught very early on in terms of the magazine publishing business that a magazine, the best way to approach it is as if the magazine were a person, because that person, that magazine, is walking into everybody's house every month, and they are expecting the same person to walk in month after month. You're a guest in their house because of the contents of that magazine and what it's all about. And therefore, the consistency of what is in the magazine, the attitude of the person of the magazine that you're inviting to the house, the stories, whatever, all should meet a certain profile. It was incredibly important piece of advice that I had been given. And I cherished running that magazine. I put people on the covers that I admired. I mean, I remember putting Lee Iacocca. I remember putting my friend Diane Sawyer on there when she first started out with Bill Curtis back at CBS on the morning show early on. I put Reagan on the cover before anybody else had Reagan on the cover. I had more fun with that magazine because it matched an important part of me, which is a combination of my positiveness and my creativity. I have built my life and my work over time. This would be after the White House days, on creative solutions to things. And so the material that we put into the magazine was really designed for people that needed to motivate themselves, people that were in the insurance business, people that had to get up every day and go out and make a living, people that had to figure out how to overcome obstacles. I mean, all this kind of stuff that basically tied back to a lot of what I had gone through post-White House days. So I learned the game planning and the organization of putting the material together and everything when I did that kind of work in the White House. But then the overcoming obstacles and all of that kind of stuff really tied to the fundamentals of some of the things I'd been through personally. So I had some real good solid experience in running that. We also, besides the magazine, we put together what we called PMA rallies. We would get anywhere from 10 to 15,000 people a day in an arena, and we would bring in Paul Harvey, Earl Nightingale. These were speakers of at that time, Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, and other people that were motivators. They were motivational speakers that had cassette programs and so forth. And we would present all of that material, and there was a real appetite for it. The self-help section of bookstores, when we first started, when I first got into this, there might be five or six books, you know, of self-help type thing. If you go to a bookstore today, you'll find 150, 200, 300 books of how to do this, how to motivate yourself to do, how to be a better speaker. You know, yeah. It's kind of like Dale Carnegie, How to Make Friends and Influence People, which came out back in the 40s. You know, it was the front runner. And then Dr. Peale with The Power of Positive Thinking, he came along and when I was around, 13 years old or so. And then this whole genre started building, and it turned out to be a hell of a business.
It's amazing, actually. And my father and myself very much benefited from this industry and the magazine. Great. By the way, we always love to have our authors read a portion of the book, and you've picked something appropriate.
This is in my book and is part of the mission statement out at the Richard Nixon Foundation, and I think it's a very important statement. President Nixon was unique among presidents. The story of his life is one of inspiration, challenges, and persistence. He influenced American and world affairs for a half a century. President Nixon was one of the most intelligent, insightful, and visionary presidents in the history of the nation. He also is the only president to ever resign. His story and that of his administration are of historic importance to future generations, and it is the Foundation's responsibility to tell that story honestly, completely, and unequivocally. And that is exactly what I tried to do in my book, The President's Man.
So what did you think, huh? I know I can be all over the place sometimes in my questioning. Look, podcasts are great, in my opinion. You've got time. I don't have to worry about the commercial break. I don't have to worry about this. I don't have to worry about that. I can let them talk. I don't have to interrupt. I can just listen, which I, strangely enough, for a big mouth like me, I truly enjoy listening. And what a great story there. I can't recommend it enough. The President's Man, The Memoirs of Nixon's Trusted Aide by Dwight Chapin. And special thanks to his friend Terry and his entire family. Okay, thank you. To be continued. I'll see you on Newsmax. You'll hear me on WABC. And yes, there will be some tweets from time to time at Greg Kelly USA. Thank you.